for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama met last night with top advisors. The topic was Afghanistan. The group convened to discuss U.S. troop levels and, according to Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, a strategy for getting them out. Joining me to discuss U.S. objectives in Afghanistan and options President Obama is considering, Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. Paul Piller is Director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He's a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. And from his office here in Washington, Ambassador Richard Haass. He's President of the Council on Foreign Relations. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Richard Haass. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Diane.
And Michael O'Hanlon, thanks for being here.
Hi, Diane. Nice to be with you.
Paul Piller, let me start with you. What do we know about last night's meeting?
Well, as usual, we're dependent on leaks and fragmentary reports, but the received wisdom seems to be that this may have been the last of the major consultations that President Obama has had with his senior advisors. And that as soon as a week from now, we may be hearing a presidential speech, perhaps a major primetime presentation, as well as congressional testimony from the likes of Secretary Clinton and Secretary Gates. And the further received wisdom is that we will be hearing about some sort of troop increase, probably in the neighborhood of 20 to 30,000 troops. And what else the president says about exit strategy and so on is really anyone's guess at this point.
Richard Haass, President Obama has been deliberating now for a number of weeks, presumably to gather more information. What do you think he may have learned about U.S. options in recent weeks?
What he probably learned is how unattractive the options are. Indeed, and that to some extent explains why it is that it took him as long as it did for him to make the decision. There's no option that anyone could walk into the Oval Office and say, if you do this, Mr. President, I have confidence it will lead to the following positive results. So instead, the president, I think, reevaluated the interests, which are not as great as several people had suggested, looked at the options, which again are not terribly attractive, but also understands that simply walking away from it is an unattractive option, which again I think explains why he's looking for some middle ground here.
And Michael O'Hanlon, as Richard Haass has said, the president has taken a long time. He's been criticized by Republicans for taking too long. Was this too long?
No, I don't think so, Diane. In addition to the excellent points that Richard Haass just made, I would add the other one, which is that we had to find some way to exercise leverage over President Karzai in Afghanistan. At the beginning of this process, he wasn't convinced he was going to respect the democratic requirements of conceding to the need for a second round of elections if he didn't have 50% of the vote in the first round. Ultimately, he wound up not to get 50% of the vote, according to the independent commissions in Afghanistan charged with making that determination. And he wasn't sure for a while whether he was just going to pocket the election anyway and override the commissions. It would have been hard for President Obama at that moment in October to approve forces. And then on top of that, we now have the ongoing issue about Afghan corruption in government. And it's very difficult for us to double down our efforts. In the end, I do support the McChrystal proposal, but it's nonetheless difficult to see how we can easily double down our bets when we are wrestling with so much corruption in Kabul. And so I think that Mr. Obama had to look for ways to gain some leverage over the Afghan government at the same time that he was trying to sort out these options in their sort of basic pure form as well.
Richard Haass, you wrote a piece back in October for the Washington Post. You ask the question, why does Afghanistan matter? And you say also the question is how much? Talk about how much Afghanistan matters.
I think it's the most important question to begin with, Diane, because at the end of the day, whatever we do has to be based upon the importance of our interests. And I would suggest that Afghanistan matters, but there's a limit to how much it matters. It's not vital to the future of the United States or to U.S. national security. The two most commonly cited arguments about why Afghanistan matters, neither one holds up to a great deal of scrutiny. One, and this is a point that Paul Pillar has also made, that there's nothing particularly unique about Afghan real estate if you're a terrorist. So the idea that Afghanistan is somehow central to the global effort against terror is simply not true in an era when al-Qaeda can use Somalia, can use Yemen, or can use Minnesota or London. Secondly, the idea that Afghanistan is central to what happens in the far more important country of Pakistan also doesn't hold up. Here the argument is that that Afghanistan could be a sanctuary, that al-Qaeda or the Taliban could use it to undermine Pakistan. And that argument would be a lot more telling if al-Qaeda and the Taliban were not already using Pakistan as a sanctuary from which to undermine Pakistan. So I'm not sitting here saying that Afghanistan has no importance whatsoever, but I actually believe there's a real ceiling or a real limit to how important it is, either in our global effort against terror or to determine the future of Pakistan, which again counts for more. And what this says to me strategically then is the United States ought not to invest more in a country. And by invest, I don't simply mean economic investment, but obviously military, diplomatic, what have you. It ought not to invest in a country more than the stakes would warrant. So this again leads me, say, to question the idea of the United States adding to what it is doing in Afghanistan. I would question that, and instead I would suggest much more. We ought to alter or modify what it is we are doing.
Richard Haas, he's president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of A War of Necessity, War of Choice, A Memoir of Two Iraq Wars. And we will open the phone shortly to take your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Paul Pillar, Richard Haas talked about the investment. We have heard figures that the cost for one American soldier for 1 year is $1 million. What is your feeling as to whether this investment, considering the points that Richard Haas has made regarding Pakistan, regarding Afghan real estate, is it worth it?
In my judgment, no. And I think Richard Haas stated very well the main observations that need to be made about the main rationales regarding terrorist safe havens and regarding Pakistan. But you quite rightly raise the other side of the equation, the cost. And it's not only the $1 million per troop per year, which if you got up to the levels that General McChrystal is talking about, means about $100 billion per year for however many years it lasts. There's all the follow-on costs that we're only beginning to see, for example, from the Iraq war, caring for our wounded veterans, all the other opportunity costs, and so on. And instead of positing stability in Afghanistan as the objective, which too much of the debate on this question has, Richard Haas was quite right. It is not a vital objective. The vital objective at the end is the safety and security of the American people. And given the human and material cost that would have to be paid, no, I don't think it's worth it.
Michael O'Hanlon, do you believe in terms of cost, in terms of security, in terms of Pakistan, that sending an additional 20 to 30,000 troops into Afghanistan is worth it?
Yes, I do, Diane. And while I recognize and acknowledge the points that Richard and Paul are making, that in the end, Afghanistan is not the central concern for us here, I feel that if we are in it, we should be in it to win, or at least to have a decent chance of success.
Win
right
what?
Now, well, right now, we're. Let me just back up and say, right now, we're sort of muddling along at 68,000. General McChrystal said in his assessment this summer he thought we were losing at that number. He may or may not still feel that way. It'll be fascinating to hear how he describes our current situation when he testifies, if he's called back in the coming weeks. But nonetheless, let's just say that we are not winning at the moment. Stalemate at best is sort of what we're doing at the moment. At $70 billion a year and 68,000 U.S. troops and 250 fatalities to our troops per year and no time horizon that we can project about when this might end. McChrystal is saying, I can't guarantee a success, but for $100 billion a year and probably a comparable amount of American casualties, we have a chance to get our arms around this issue. And we can go on in the discussion. I can talk more about what you can do with 100,000 troops that you can't do with 68,000. But if you're in it, you should be in it to win. We are heavily engaged in a military operation. And the idea of staying in this sort of neither fish nor fowl position at 70,000 U.S. troops doesn't make much sense to me. It's not enough to do proper counterinsurgency. It's too much to do a narrow counterterrorism mission. And so, therefore, I think where we are does not really hold water.
Tell me how you would define winning.
A reasonable level of stability in the Afghan government and greater proficiency in their security forces so they can ultimately fight this war on their own, so we can have an exit strategy. So we're building up Afghan institutions. That's the core element of what we have to do, especially the security forces, and in the meantime, keep a lid on the insurgency.
Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, also here in the studio, Paul Pillar of Georgetown University, and on the line with us, Ambassador Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. Short break and right back. And welcome back. As we talk about the meeting that was held last night with President Obama and his National Security Advisor, other advisors, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, on what to do next in Afghanistan, whether to follow the recommendation of General McChrystal for 40,000 additional troops, whether to take another tack. Here's an email from Kurt in Stillman Valley, Illinois. If we have 70,000 troops there now and increase that by 40,000, that's a 57% escalation. This is a lot like Johnson escalating Vietnam. We don't want to lose, but we don't know how to win. Didn't the Russians have 500,000 troops there? Did McChrystal not say that even if he gets his 40,000, we could be in the same shape we are now in 20 years down the road? Paul Pillar.
Actually, if I'm not mistaken, the level of the Soviet troop effort in Afghanistan back in the 1980s only reached a little over 100,000. So if General McChrystal were to get everything he asked for, it would be almost exactly the same as what the Soviets
and
had.
And how long were the Soviets there?
Well, 10 years from the initial invasion in 1979 until the last general left, walked across the bridge into the Soviet Union in 1989.
And what did he say when he walked across that bridge?
Oh, I can't remember. Do you remember, Diane?
No, I don't remember, but I'm just wondering what the reports were afterwards.
We should back up a bit. The Soviets had already begun their drawdown about 3 years previously, around 1986. So they had an Afghanization program. And by the way, we should point out that the government they left behind, that of Najibullah, clung on to power for another 3 years, which was longer than most people expected.
Richard Haas, what are the known splits within the administration and among the president's security advisors as to the way forward in Afghanistan?
I would say that on one side of the debate, you essentially have people in uniform, both in the field and in Washington. You've got the Secretary of Defense and you've got the Secretary of State. And they've been essentially supportive of General McChrystal. And just to be fair to the general, the 40,000 troop increase is simply one part of what he is opting for. And he's talking about a comprehensive strategy that also involves economic development, trying to improve the governance of a very flawed Afghan partner, trying to win over some of the Taliban, so to essentially get them to change sides and to put a greater emphasis on training. So, but that's one side. On the other side, I think you essentially have the Vice President, Mr. Biden, and many of the political people around the president, and they are questioning the wisdom of a buildup, essentially looking to some extent at the parallels both between this president and Johnson with Vietnam, but also between this president and his predecessor, George W. Bush. And they don't want Afghanistan to become as central to this administration as Iraq, a previous war of choice, was to the 43rd president. So they are questioning going down this path, in part because they don't have confidence in a year that General McChrystal won't come back and say, actually, now I need another 40,000 troops. There's so much about the history and political culture of Afghanistan that warns outsiders, even outsiders such as ourselves who are there by invitation, that warns us against getting ambitious. And I think what the debate in the administration essentially is around is this question of what can we really accomplish, and will doing more militarily, Diane, will that really yield more in any way that's commensurate with the investment? And that's the fundamental split in the administration.
And as far as what you are hearing, who seems to be winning this debate, Richard Haas?
I think it's interesting. This debate has gone back and forth. Initially, if you remember, the president, even before his first review was done, within the first 2 months of his presidency, increased troops by 21,000. Then he was going to go ahead and do what General McChrystal wanted. Vice President Biden intervened last summer, and things slowed down. And what you've now had is a rather extraordinary 3 or 4 months of debate. I don't know any other word for it, and deliberation. I don't think the word dithering is fair, but deliberation and debate within the administration. I would say right now, I think those who are favoring troop increases have the upper hand. It may not be every last troop the general wants, but it'll probably be close to it, particularly once you factor in likely increases in contributions from America's allies. And I think the argument the president's going to make, something Michael Hanlon alluded to, is that the United States should essentially elect to build up in order to build down. The argument will be we need to send in more troops now to buy time and space for the Afghans so they can train up their police and their military forces. And again, I think the big flaw or question mark around the argument is whether this corrupt government will ever be seen as legitimate in the eyes of most Afghans, whether it will ever be able to deliver the basics of what governments want to, and whether it's really possible to build up a loyal, professional Afghan army and Afghan police force that will do what we want it to do the morning after U.S. troops depart. And that, I think, is the biggest single question mark, Diane, and what General McChrystal and others who favor doing more, it's the one point they really can't answer. Can we do anything that will endure in Afghanistan? And history, again, teaches us to be quite modest.
two questions, Michael O'Hanlon. First, how much of a contribution do we expect from other countries to support U.S. troops?
I believe, Diane, that it's likely to wind up in the range of a couple thousand. Now, there have been some indications in the last few days that maybe it'll be a few thousand, but that is the optimistic scenario. And in any event, it's going to be probably no more than 5,000, with Britain leading the way. It would be impressive, frankly, if 5,000 additional NATO troops who are non-American were ultimately deployed.
But there has certainly been resistance from those NATO countries.
There's no doubt. Although, you know, the British debate on this topic, a number of the debates are fascinating. The Canadian debate is quite interesting because Canada per capita has taken more casualties than we have, and they've really restructured their military and their whole attitude towards national security. In the 1990s, their armed forces were basically peacekeepers at best. And now they are fighting in some of the most difficult part of Afghanistan and Kandahar. The British debate, you know, General McChrystal got in trouble for a couple of comments that people didn't consider politic, but the British chief of the general staff has actually said this is a huge challenge to Western civilization to get this war right. And he has been even more forward-leaning than anyone on the DOD side in the U.S. debate. So Britain and Canada have shown elements of hawkishness. Now, Canada wants out in 2011,
yes.
And so you're right, it is very complicated, but the Allied picture is a little more nuanced than some people understand.
And Paul Pillar, the second question on corruption. There is a piece this morning that talks about 15 of the members of Karzai's cabinet being brought into for questioning. Now, with that much widespread corruption, how do we as a country get in there and help that country come to grips with its own problems?
Well, it's a key question. And if you listen to members of Congress on various sides of the issue and both sides of the aisle, it has become one of the premier concerns on Capitol Hill about Afghanistan. It also strikes to the heart of one of the tenets of counterinsurgency doctrine and practice, which is that you need a legitimate government that you are trying to defend and whose longevity you are trying to protect. And corruption and legitimacy go hand in hand in an opposite sort of way. It is a tremendous drain on the legitimacy of the Karzai government. And a further question to raise, Diane, is to what extent Afghanistan can work at all over the next few years without corruption? I mean, is this part of the grease that makes what wheels we have in that country or what wheels they have turn at all? And I think to a large extent it is.
What's the alternative to sending in 20 to 40,000 troops into Afghanistan? The president's press secretary talked about an exit strategy that presumably would have been after sending in more troops. But suppose, just suppose, the president said no more troops. Richard Haass, what would happen?
What he would and should do, in my view, would be to put much greater emphasis on training. And when I say training, Diane, I don't simply mean the central police force and the army of Afghanistan, because, as you know, Afghanistan has such a tradition of weak central institutions. But instead, I would look for people to train in the periphery, in the villages and towns, tribal leaders, regional authorities, and so forth. So I would do much more training rather than war fighting. I would try to bribe as many of the people who call themselves Taliban to reconsider their loyalties. And I'd put far greater emphasis on Pakistan. We haven't talked about it much, but it's strategically deeply flawed to be spending $25 or $30 in Afghanistan for every dollar we're spending in Pakistan. It's Pakistan that has 100 nuclear weapons. It's Pakistan that has five times the population. It's Pakistan that's host to and tolerating groups like al-Qaeda. It's Pakistan that can deeply influence the fate of its neighbor, India. So I would say if the United States is going to make investments in this part of the world, I would favor far more looking for ways that we could try to steer the future of Pakistan's government. One other thing we should do when Pakistan is allow the Pakistanis to export things like textiles into the United States. That would, again, help boost their economy and would have tremendous political and importance there. But I would limit what it is we're doing in Afghanistan. It's not on the edge. people who advocate doing more have not made a persuasive argument that if we don't do more, somehow Afghanistan is going to fall through the door tomorrow. I don't think it is.
Michael O'Hanlon.
Richard's certainly right to raise the Pakistan issue, and I know we'll come back to it. I just want to talk a little bit about the training issue. General McChrystal is as focused on this as he could possibly be, and I believe this will come out as we hear more about the strategy. And again, Richard Haass did a very nice job of explaining all the things that go along with the troop increase proposal. McChrystal wants to do apprenticeship. He wants every single NATO unit to have an Afghan sister unit. There is not going to be any more intensive way to do training than what McChrystal himself is proposing. Now, it is true that we could back off a bit and wait until they were capable of doing more and just not do as much fighting ourselves. We do have that option. But I don't really believe that there is any game plan in town being discussed that would be more focused on training than McChrystal himself is. He wants to, again, do an apprenticeship with each and every Afghan police or army unit. So there will be a sister NATO unit of comparable size that will live, train, deploy, and fight together. And that's the whole reason for much of the troop increase that he's proposing.
How realistic is that, Paul Pillar?
It's realistic, but part of the background that hasn't been mentioned so far is the extent to which we are creating more adversaries and more enemies on the battlefield through our own presence and our own combat operations. Many of the people who are now our enemies, firing at us, shooting at our people, that are loosely put under the label Taliban, are ones who have no ideological or other affinity for what we know of as the Taliban leadership. They are other Afghans who are unhappy about what they see as a foreign occupation. They are unhappy about the collateral damage that is an unavoidable result of even the most carefully planned and skillfully executed military operations. We are creating our own enemies. So I think it's a fallacy to think that if we're going to be in there for some time, it's going to sort of bridge this gap until the Afghans can take it over. We're making the gap worse by creating enemies.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Springboro, Ohio. Good morning, John.
Good morning. First-time listener. Our caller, long-time listener.
I'm glad. Thank you.
I have a question for about the strategic reasons for being in Afghanistan. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mr. Haass was talking earlier about that. I believe at the very beginning I heard some stuff on the news about opening up a natural gas pipeline from gas fields in Uzbekistan or someplace going across Afghanistan. And I believe, again, I'm not sure, but I thought Mr. Karzai was an executive with a natural gas company. How does that play into the strategic, importance of Afghanistan?
All right, Paul Pillar.
Well, there have been ambitions and talk about this for years about various gas and oil pipelines, particularly that would take some of the resources of the Central Asian countries, such as Turkmenistan, which has enormous natural gas resources, and bring them south where they could be exported from ports on the Indian Ocean. But in terms of how this actually plays into the real debate that has been conducted in the White House Situation Room, I don't think that has been a significant factor. It has instead been these other things we've talked about, terrorism, Pakistan, and the rest.
All right, to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Angelo. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. You have done a tremendous work, by the way, in exploring the Afghanistan issue. You had a few shows on it. The last show was much more hawkish, and this show sounds much more dovish, or at least much more balanced. But my statement is very simple. A statement was made before that we have too many troops there for an interdiction effort and not enough for a nation-building effort. So the question has been, well, should we throw enough in to get the nation-building effort? Turn it on its side. Should we go back to the future and go back to what we went to Afghanistan for in the first place, which was simply to knock the heck out of Al-Qaeda? If that's the case, We can limit our effort there, work out a deal with the Pakistanis and the Afghanis to go in there when we have identified targets of opportunity, and simply get back to where it was.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Michael O'Hanlon.
Well, this does get to the important issue of what are the fundamental stakes. And I do believe, I'm half persuaded by what Ambassador Haas and Paul Pillar are saying, in the sense that Afghanistan is not the ultimate prize in this region. And by the way, even though I support McChrystal, in a year and a half, we may have to acknowledge that his plan has failed. And then it's going to be backup plan time, and I'm going to be hoping that these arguments about the limited importance of Afghanistan are correct. But I would add a couple of points. First of all, the Taliban has gotten more extreme over the years, and they are not just people who want to rule their little sector of Afghanistan necessarily anymore. The Haqqani Network, another militia in Afghanistan, is very extreme, as the accounts of David Rhodes' kidnapping attest. So it's harder to say that al-Qaeda is just one narrow group in one specific place. There's a lot more to say as well, but maybe after the break.
Michael O'Hanlon, he's Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. We'll take a short break. More of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provide solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk has won international acclaim, a Nobel Prize for Literature, and scrutiny from his government. He discusses his new book, The Museum of Innocence, and the real museum he's creating, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about options that President Obama is considering regarding the war in Afghanistan, here's an email from Bernard, who says, "Let us be very clear. Fundamentally, our policy regarding troop increases or withdrawals is not a vote on American integrity. It's a vote on the possibility of Afghan integrity. American troops have performed with integrity by all reports. They essentially are missionaries for the decent treatment of women in that society. The question is, are Afghans worth it? Can they get their act together to deserve American blood and treasure?" Paul Pillar.
Well, I think that's a very appropriate perspective, and it speaks right to the issue of cost versus benefits. The American military and American civilians who have been in Afghanistan absolutely have observed the utmost integrity, and I might add a great deal of skill and courage as well, and we all need to be grateful for them. So what are we buying by their sacrifices is the key question here. So I would just applaud Bernard's way of phrasing the question.
And for you, Michael O'Hanlon, this from Dixon in Michigan. Why is it not being asked? If the security of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Israel, Jordan, and other Mideast U.S. allies are being helped by U.S. soldiers fighting in Afghanistan, where are the Egyptian, Saudi, Israeli, and Jordanian troops? Why is the war on terror only a U.S. and Canadians on the front line war? Weren't the 9/11 attackers from Saudi and Egypt? Why isn't this issue being raised?
It's a very good point, and I think it is time that, especially maybe in the north and west of Afghanistan, we start working harder to broaden this coalition. Let's face it, a lot of militaries are simply not willing to be in the south and the east, even among our own close allies, because of the intensity of the fighting. I'm not going to stand here and defend Egypt or Saudi Arabia's perspective, but I think it would be unrealistic to expect that perspective to change radically to the point where they send their military forces to Kandahar or Helmand. However, I think it's overdue that we work harder to try to convince them to go up to some of the somewhat more peaceful parts of the North and West, which are not unimportant and which are under greater threat today, where they could make a real contribution. So I think the basic gist of the question is correct.
Let's go now to Lisa in Cary, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Diane.
Sure.
This is really a question, I think, for the whole panel, but just from what I've read and listened to about Afghanistan, in particular this conversation this morning, I mean, do people think that we can really, you know, quote-unquote, win here? It just sounds to me like there's just the highest of hurdles to overcome. And, can we do that in a year or two with 40,000 more troops or 80,000 more troops? It just seems like it's something impossible that we're trying to attain. And just coming from someone who doesn't maybe have as much knowledge as others, but it just sounds crazy to me that we even are thinking about, moving forward with this. And
Richard Haas.
I think Lizzie's question is in some ways the most important one. It's the one that Barack Obama's been struggling with. If by win do you mean can we create an Afghanistan that is a functioning, normal state, the short answer is no. It never has been, and it won't be. I think instead the U.S. objective is not to lose terribly. It's funny, David Petraeus, who's now the central commander and used to be the commander in Iraq, used to say our goal in Iraq was to make things, quote-unquote, good enough. And I think the real question, Diane, now for Afghanistan is what is good enough? And it's not so much then what we want to achieve, but it's rather what we want to avoid. And what we want to avoid is having a Taliban takeover of the country and having al-Qaeda, say, come back in there in force. And it's really going to be up to the Afghans, their police, their military, their government, to prevent that from happening. And the real question is, what should the United States be prepared to do to help them? Which is, again, why I challenge the emphasis on war fighting, and I think the emphasis ought to be on training and better government. But I think that's probably the most we can hope for. We've got to, again, even modest goals here are going to prove extraordinarily difficult. So to set ambitious goals here seems to me to be really asking for trouble and would run the risk of actually distorting American foreign policy. The president's just back from a trip to Asia, China. He's got the Indian prime minister in town today for a state dinner. Those are the subjects that ought to be the center of American foreign policy. That's the future. Afghanistan is not going to determine much about the 21st century, but China, India, Japan, what happens in Europe, what happens in Brazil, those are the real questions we ought to be focusing on, or climate change or what have you. This is not a place that Barack Obama wants to be spending hour after hour with his senior staff.
Let's hear an email from Paul, who's in Peterborough, New Hampshire, who says General McChrystal's recommendations were made before the election exposed the Afghan administration to be as shockingly corrupt as it appears to be. Since McChrystal's recommendations depend on working through the Afghan government and propping it up, would his recommendations have been the same if They were submitted after the election. Paul Pillar.
Well, I think Michael can speak more directly to that. My suspicion is they would be basically the same. I think probably General McChrystal recognizes he has an even harder task, he and Ambassador Eikenberry, given the blatant corruption of the election. And that goes back to the issue we touched on earlier about the importance of a legitimacy of legitimacy in the government you're trying to protect in any counterinsurgency effort.
If, in fact, the president does announce an increase in troops, do you believe, Michael O'Hanlon, he will also outline an exit strategy at the same time?
I think he has to. I think the basic point is we have to train up Afghan institutions. And we, so on this point, Richard and Paul and myself and I think President Obama will agree. The question is, what else has to go along with that strategy? I've emphasized, and McChrystal emphasizes, this apprenticeship concept. If you think about that, building up a police force and an army that's large enough and then at least partially competent enough to hold relative control of its territory. And that's my minimal goal for success. Then you have roughly a 3 to 4 year period of the most intensive preparation, after which you can begin to draw down if it works. Now, commanders don't tend to like to say even something that specific because they know how many things may get in the grease or in the gears and slow things down. But that is basically the schedule that we would be on. If I could add a quick point on anti-corruption, I think it is important, while we emphasize the difficulties in Kabul and with the Karzai government, to remember that at the local level, a lot of what we're doing now with these Afghan security forces is itself an anti-corruption plan because we are out there partnering with them. And one of the things that you do when you partner is you figure out which of their commanders are good and which ones aren't.
How do you do that?
Because we're working with them day in and day out. Let me just explain the logic train, if you don't mind, and then you can come back. And once we see how these people operate in the field, if they are willing to risk their troops' lives, if they are willing to lead them into difficult places, if the reputation that these people have is relatively clean among their own citizens, because we're out there talking to those citizens ourselves by virtue of our strategy, then we can go to Minister of Interior Atmar or Minister of Defense Wardak, who I think are both a little bit better officials than many of the others in the Afghan government, and say, these people need to be changed or reformed or improved upon. Can you do something about it? That interaction is occurring now in a way that it hadn't before because of the level of intensity of our engagement.
How much are we going to have to pay each of these commanders, Paul Pillar?
Probably less than we'd be spending on our own military operations. But the one point I'd like to add to all this is just the time perspective. The Karzai government has been in power for 8 years. And we all know the story of relative inattention under the previous administration that was focusing on Iraq and so on. But I think it really puts into perspective the question of how much more we can expect in terms of better performance, cleaner performance, less corruption, all these things we've talked about over the next 3 years, this what is described as this critical window, or General McChrystal would even make it the next year, year and a half, when we're already 8 years into the war.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Fred. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. My question, and what's always perplexed me about this, is how do you have a legitimate army when you don't have a legitimate government running that army? I hear the decentralization talk, but I mean, you can't have a legitimate army without a central government. And that's my question. I look forward to your comments.
And to you, Richard Haas.
Well, what I want to see is a capable army. And that means something at the national level. But given Afghanistan's nature, it probably also means finding local people we can work with, in some ways similar to what happened in Iraq, as you will recall, where the goal, in addition to building up central institution, was to winning over important tribal leaders, the so-called Sunni awakening. And I think we need to do the same thing throughout Afghanistan. Legitimacy it will come from the government. It'll come from an army and a police force that have hopefully been trained to act professionally. Again, I wouldn't aim too high. I'm simply looking for some capacity here so the country essentially, so security in the country doesn't unravel.
I asked earlier what it was the Russian general had said as he was walking across the bridge. And as usual, we can count on our listeners to come through. And this is from John, who says, as the Russian general stood on the bridge, the last to leave, he said, quote, You Americans may think you have won, but I can tell you the people who will take over here are no friends of yours, unquote. At the time, John says, it set a shiver with the thought of Stinger missiles in general circulation. I've often wondered why this is not replayed on occasion. And here we are, all these years later. Let's take a call from Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for putting me on the air.
Sure.
Hey, I am just I'm just some guy. I don't have a lot of expertise in military or foreign affairs. I'm really echoing something Lisa called about earlier. In 2003, there was so much hype over Iraq and really no proof of the weapons of mass destruction, and people got taken in. And there was a lot of emotional stuff going around. There's a lot of panic over it, but some people saw through it. Some people said that this invasion of Iraq is uncalled for and there's no basis for it. Michael O'Hanlon was not one of those people. I'm just some guy. I saw through it. So I'm asking, where is the credibility and where is the accountability? This is the man who cheered the surge. And Mr. O'Hanlon, you said that in Iraq, 2007 would be the make-or-break year. Well, which was it?
Well, it's actually, even though you're obviously not a big fan of mine, it's obviously a fairly reasonable summary of, I think, what I got right and wrong in the last 5 years. I was of the opinion that if we were going to go into Iraq, we had to do it with serious commitment. It was an op-ed that I wrote, along with Phil Gordon, that provoked Ken Edelman to write his famous cakewalk reply in which he said it would be easy. Phil and I said, no, it won't be easy. And if we're going to do it, we should at least do it with eyes open. But I take your point. In retrospect, I'm not sure that I would have supported the war. On the other hand, supporting the surge was clearly vindicated by the military progress, and I hope ultimately the political progress that we've seen in Iraq since.
Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Finally, to you, Richard Haass, what course do you hope the president will choose in Afghanistan?
What I would hope he would do, Diane, is limit what the United States is going to do. I would not favor more troops being sent there. I would favor a much greater emphasis on training up the Afghans, both in Kabul and throughout the country. More focused efforts to win over at least some of the Taliban, which I think is totally plausible, and far greater focus on its neighbor Pakistan rather than making a massive new investment in Afghanistan.
And Paul Pillar.
Within the realm of what's politically realistic, I think exactly what Richard Haass says is what the most we can expect and the best that I would hope for. You know, one thing we haven't talked about, Diane, is why the unspoken option of orderly disengagement was taken off the table initially for political reasons, basically.
Who took it off the
table?
Well, the
president made it quite clear himself, and his spokesman, Mr. Gibbs, did. You know, there is no logical, strategic reason why it should not have been on the table, even if it were not the option eventually chosen.
And but we know, why was it taken off the table?
Well, because partly the president has put himself into a box with earlier declarations of Afghanistan being a war of necessity and so on. And also because of the asymmetry with which recriminations on these things tend to work. If he did disengage, then all it would take is one not very big terrorist incident that had some Afghan connection, and the president would be absolutely pilloried from various political directions by people saying, see what happened, you didn't have the spine to stay the course, and now we're seeing terrorism coming out of Afghanistan.
Michael O'Hanlon, what do you hope will come from the president's deliberations?
I think that we have a decent chance at an effective counterinsurgency strategy. Our military has never been better at doing this sort of thing. There is some hopefulness in the progress of the Afghan army. It's too small. It's not as good as it needs to be across the board, but it shows that some kind of a reasonably decent Afghan institution can be built. That needs to get bigger and better. The police need to be fundamentally reformed. But we have a plan now that, unlike the last 8 years, is much more intensively focused on building up these Afghan institutions. So I'm hopeful that over the next 12 to 18 months, we'll see major progress. And then within about 3 years, we can begin to see an American drawdown.
Do you think that's realistic? Paul?
realistic that we can see a drawdown within 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's realistic, but only because the American public mood will change so much in the direction that we've got to get out, the costs are too high, that something closer to perceived defeat than perceived victory will be politically acceptable.
Aren't the numbers showing us that the American public is already asking why we are there?
Oh, absolutely. And you can compare those numbers, say, with the curve of the polling numbers during the Vietnam War, and the conclusion would be, when we're out about 3 years from now, this will not be a politically acceptable war.
Paul Pillar, Director of Graduate Studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Ambassador Richard Haass is President of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of A War of Necessity, War of Choice. And Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.